This is elementary Greek grammar lesson 5, nouns of the first declension. Paragraph 5.1, vocabulary list. I will read through these nouns simply. Before I do, I would like to point out a couple of things. We have both masculine and feminine nouns, but the great majority of nouns of the first declension are feminine. The reason that they are a declension is because they have the letter eta, the long form of epsilon, which shows up in the endings of these nouns. That eta does not determine the gender. The gender is determined by the article that follows it. I will read these nouns in the left-hand column first. Agape, aletheia, hamartia, notice the rough breathing, basileia, glossa, graphe, didache, doxa, irene, ecclesia, right-hand column, intelle, exousia, hemera, notice the rough breathing, mathetes, messias, hadas, another rough breathing, parabole, prophetes, hora, another rough breathing, zoe. Now, the paragraph 5.2 is a review, the Greek masculine neuter article review. Notice the articles are the same as we've already presented. It says in the paragraph above the chart, in the previous lesson we observed this chart of the masculine and neuter articles. All masculine and neuter articles will follow these forms, no matter what the masculine or neuter ending set is. I will not read through them again. I've already done that once for you. If you have any questions, let me know. Paragraph 5.3, the Greek feminine article. The following chart contains the feminine article used only with feminine nouns, but translated like the masculine articles and the neuter articles as far as that's concerned. All feminine articles will follow these forms no matter what the feminine ending set is. There's more than one feminine set of endings. On the next page, actually, you'll find the feminine articles. I will read through these. These are listed from one form through four, forms one through four, singular and then plural. The singular article is he, form two, tes, form three, te, and note the iota subscript, form four, tain, the plural, hi, form two, tone, form three, tis, form four, tos. You will notice that in the plural forms, the second and third form, form two and three, are identical with the masculine and the neuter. Those forms are stable in Greek and they never change. Paragraph 5.3, the feminine stem. The feminine nouns in the vocabulary list have three different stems. These are not obvious at first glance, so the following chart will identify which nouns end in each stem. Note that the ending has been separated from the stem by a dash for the purposes of emphasis. Of course, this will not occur in the New Testament. No dash will be there. Observe the last letter of each stem. All feminine nouns of the second declension will fit under one of these headings. Now, that chart is very important. It is a chart that has three sets of endings. The left-hand column, stems ending in epsilon, iota, rho. Center column, stems ending in sigma, a sibilant, or double lambda. And the right-hand column, stems ending in any other letter. So I'm going to go through and read them to you from starting with the left-hand column. Notice that the stem ends in either epsilon, iota, or rho. In point of fact, in this particular list, all the stems ending either in iota or rho. There are no epsilon ending stems here, but sometimes they do occur. They're not as common. The first word, aletheia, the stem ends in iota, just before the alpha ending. Hamartia, basileia, ecclesia, exousia, hemera, there's a rho ending stem. Hora, there's a rho ending stem. So all of them end in either iota or rho. The second column, all the stems in sigma end in sigma, or a sibilant, or a double lambda. In this particular list, there are only two. There are two nouns, glossa, which ends in sigma, and doxa, which ends in xi, which is considered a sibilant. A sibilant is any consonant that is combined with an S sound. So xi has a S sound built into to the letter sound. Therefore, it's a sibilant. We'll get to double lambda later. The last column, and there are many nouns in this column, stems ending in any other letter. They are graphe, which ends in phi, didache, which ends in chi, irene, which ends in nu, intele, which ends in lambda, but it's a single lambda. If it were a double lambda, it would be in the center column. Parabole, another stem ending in lambda, and zoe, a stem ending in a vowel. These happen on occasion. In this case, it's the long vowel omega. So that's the any other list for this particular lesson. We'll be coming back to these as we go through the various lessons. You will notice that these endings are mostly alpha in the nominative. A few have an eta. For this reason, the first declension is called the alpha declension, or sometimes the alpha-eta declension. These stem endings are important. This is not as big a burden as it seems. For one thing, all the plural endings are identical, as we will see when we get to the chart, no matter what the stem ending. Secondly, the changes are logical and not random. The more you learn Greek, the more you'll find out the language is highly logical by and large. Paragraph 5.4.1, the inflectional endings on a feminine epsilon iota rho stem. Now, this stem is one of the most common, and so we'll find these endings occurring a lot in the New Testament. I've listed for you the four forms in this chart, singular and plural, for the word aletheia. Aletheia, the truth, is read this way in the singular, and I'm just going to read down through forms 1, 2, 3, and 4. Aletheia, aletheias, aletheia, aletheion. Now notice that I've given you a translation for each of those. I want to repeat that these translations are the most common translations when these words occur by themselves. And you choose from one of these if you can. As we study Greek, we'll find there are many other translations that can go with, especially forms 2 and 3. Instead of or from truth, for instance, form 2 can be by truth or even in truth on occasion. Form 3, usually to, in, or by truth, but there are many other possible translations for that as well. These are the most common, and in first year Greek, we will stick pretty much with these, and if they do vary, I will explain the variations to you as we go through the course. The plural forms for aletheia are aletheiai, aletheion, aletheiais, and aletheias. Again, truths, of or from truths, to, in, or by truths, and then truths as an object. All first declension feminine nouns with the stem ending in epsilon, iota, or rho will carry these endings. We'll go on now. This was just for explanatory purposes. Let's look at the noun hora, also an epsilon iota rho ending. Exactly the same endings. I read down through this. This is hora, the word for hour. Hora, horas, hora, with the Yoda subscript, Horon, Horai, Horon, Horais, Horas. Same set of endings. Paragraph 5.4.2, the inflectional endings on a feminine sigma sibilant double lambda stem. And then I've listed the various letters for you. The sigma, then there are three sibilants, zeta, xi, and psi. You can hear the S sound in each of those. And then the double lambda. The following shows the endings for hey doxa, the glory. All first declension feminine nouns whose stems end in a sigma, a sibilant, or a double lambda will follow the same pattern. Notice the change from the previous chart. I'm going to read the word doxa in its various forms. Form 1 through 4. Doxa, doxace, doxa with the iota subscript, doxon. Here you will notice that they're basically the same endings, except in forms 2 and 3, we have the eta instead of the alpha. This is the way that this particular set of stems always ends in the singular. But look at the plural. I will read them. Doxai, doxon, doxais, doxos, exactly the same endings as the previous one. The plural endings never change. The only changes are in the singular endings. I've given you another chart. This one for hey glossa, the tongue, has exactly the same set of endings. I will read through it. Glossa, glossase, glossae with the iota subscript, glosson. Glossae, glosson, glossais, glossos. Paragraph 5.4.3, the inflectional endings on a feminine any other stem. The following chart shows the endings for hey graphe, the writing, the scripture. Here you will notice that in the singular column, the endings are always eta. Graphe, graphase, graphe with the iota subscript, graphane. The plurals, however, have exactly the same endings as the other two sets. Graphi, graphon, graphi, graphice, graphos. Now, so then, it's very clear that this declension is very strongly of a certain set. The changes have only to do with two letters, alphas and etas. Otherwise, things stay the same. There are a good number of nouns in both of these forms. The following chart shows the same endings for the noun agape, love. So I will give that to you, and that's on the next page, actually. Forms 1 through 4. Agape, agapes, agape, agapane. Agapai, agapon, agapais, agapas. Now, chart 5.4.4 is a chart that includes all the inflectional endings for every first declension feminine noun. Feminine stem noun is the way I phrased it. The following chart lists the endings for each of the stem forms. This is what you should memorize. And you really need to spend some time on this chart. It will really help you in the long run. And I recommend going back and reviewing these charts for noun endings as often as you can in first year Greek. Over the years, if you stay with Greek, they will become almost second nature to you. You won't even stop to think about them anymore. But at this point, you need to concentrate on these. Here are the noun stem endings in the singular for each of the different changes. The first one with the stems ending in epsilon, iota, rho. Here's the way I memorize them and what I recommend that you do. Pronounce them out loud in this manner. Ah, os, ah, on. Very simple. That's epsilon, iota, rho rule ending. The sigma, sibilant, or double lambda rule is ah, ace, a, on. And the noun stems ending in any other letter, a, ace, a, ain. You can easily see the progression from left to right. All alphas in the left-hand column, two alphas and two etas in the middle column, and all etas in the right-hand column. Notice that any noun of the second declension, plural, has the same endings. I own, ice, os. The first declension masculine plurals are identical to the first declension feminine plurals above. All the plurals for all the stem endings are identical. The vocative, which rarely occurs with some of these nouns, carries the same endings as the nominatives. And it's for that reason that some believe that the vocatives are really not a separate case, and maybe they aren't, but we'll just leave it at that. Paragraph 5.5. The masculine stem and its endings. Remember we had three nouns that were masculine? A limited number of masculine nouns reside in the first declension. In the vocabulary list, we presented the following first declension masculine nouns. Mathetes, or ha mathetes, disciple or learner. It really comes from the word manthano, which means to learn something. But it came to mean a follower or a disciple. The word Messiah, Messias, and that's capitalized because it's technically a title of Jesus in the New Testament. And then the word prophet, haprophetes. Now these follow a little different set of endings in the masculine singular, but they're all the same masculine singular endings. Really what it is it's the any other rule ending with a change in the form two. And some changes, change in forms 1 and 2, but it's the any other rule ending in because the letter eta is the primary letter of it. Form 1, ace, oo, a, ain. And the fifth form is actually an alpha, an ah. And this is a peculiarity of only these particular nouns. The plural is I, own, ice, os, just like, identical to the feminine nouns. Notice that each one of them ends in a masculine ace instead of a and has the regular oo sound for the second form, the over from form. So that's the only changes as far as the masculines are concerned. I recommend that you learn them, memorize them as they're given. I wouldn't worry too much about the form 5. I gave it for information purposes only. There are a few places where vocatives occur with 5, but it's rather rare. There's a special note on Messias on the next page. The noun Messias is peculiar since it is not actually a Greek word. It is a Hebrew word that was spelled with Greek letters. When a noun from another language is spelled with Greek letters, it is transliterated rather than translated into Greek. This happens often with proper names, such as Jesus, Simon, Jerusalem, Abraham, Isaac, Jude, etc., all of which are Hebrew words. Also, such words were assigned a set of Greek endings, which vary with the noun involved and must be learned by observation. And I need to make a comment here. Proper names in Greek often have the word the article in front of it. And if that word doesn't change its ending to indicate like a second form, doesn't go into oo or whatever the second form would be, oftentimes the article will be a second form article too. Same thing with if it's an accusative. Sometimes it'll have an accusative ending, a proper name will. Other times it'll just have the article tain, or, the accusative article is what I meant to say. So there's no real problem with them. You'll be able to tell when they occur and how they will occur with their articles when you see them. However, the noun Messias only occurs twice, two times, in the New Testament in two different verses. One of them is John 1:41, where the accusative form occurs, Messian or Messian, it's spelled two different ways, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Or in John 4:25, that's the second place where the word occurs. Notice only John uses this transliterated noun. There the nominative occurs, Messias or Messias. Now, the two spellings, I have a note on that. Messian or Messian in the accusative, or Messias in the nominative, with the two sigmas in both cases, occur because of the different manuscript families from which the New Testament was copied. The majority of changes in manuscripts are spelling changes and do not bear on the meaning of the text. Which spelling was the original is impossible to tell, though the older manuscripts have the second spelling with a double sigma. Though it may be so for dialectical rather than age reasons. Just because they're older doesn't mean that's the reason that the double sigma is there. It could be that the North African dialect required it because the older manuscripts are North African. So don't worry about it. It just occurs and it's not terribly important. It's the same word no matter how it's spelled. Diagramming the oblique cases, paragraph 5.6. We're getting into diagramming now. I'm going to be teaching diagramming through this course. I think it's important to learn how to deal with the syntax of the New Testament. And the most simple way to do that is to learn to diagram. How much you get into this will be up to you, obviously, as you go through your Christian studies in the New Testament, your biblical studies, rather, in the New Testament. I diagram everything that I can when I can. It helps me settle certain questions. And when you diagram something, you're forced to deal with every word, look at them collectively, and see how they actually work. I think this is a very valuable thing. It brings up questions that you might not otherwise ask yourself. So I'm going to show you some basic diagramming techniques, starting with the example ha, adelphos, graphi, ton logon. And then I gave you the translation, the brother writes the word. Or it could be translated, the brother is writing the word. Depends on how you see the context. Then I've diagrammed it for you. The subject, adelphos, is on the subject side of the predicate line. That's the line that goes up and down. Graphi is in the place of the predicate, the verb. And logon is in the predicate position of the direct object. Each of those nouns, adelphos and logon, have an article which is diagrammed, as you can see, beneath the word to which it relates. This is a simple way of doing it. Now, we call those lines certain things just for convenience sake. For instance, the line that adelphos, graphi, and logon sit on is called the basal line, B-A-S-A-L, because these are considered basal parts. That word is basal, not base. Some people get confused on that. Basal is a technical grammatical term that refers to the structure of the sentence or a clause in its basal forms. The line that separates the subject and the predicate is called the predicate line or the subject line, depending on which system you use. Remember that that's what it's for, to separate the subject from the predicate. The line that separates the verb from the object is called the object line. Very simple terminology. The line or set of lines actually that go below the nouns are called usually just simply modifying lines, because these same kinds of lines are used for adverbs as well as adjectives and for participles and other things as we get to them, which is going to be quite a ways down the road. Note on the parsing above then. If the subject of the verb is a singular noun or third-person pronoun, like he, she, or it, the verb will be third-person singular in form. So graphi in the thing above is third-person singular. If the subject is plural, the form will become third-person plural. It is important. The reason I read that first is because you will note that every time you parse. Parsing simply breaks down the verbal action or the verbal concepts into all of its elements. For instance, graphi is present tense. That's all we've learned so far. We haven't learned any past tense verbs or future tense. Present, so I always put the tense first. And then the transitiveness. Traditionally, this was voice, but there are many verbs in the New Testament that have no voice, but they're still transitive. They're transitive passive. Well, they have voice. They're intransitive, rather. I shouldn't have said transitive. They become intransitive. They're the same verb, can either be transitive or intransitive. A transitive active verb has to have a direct object. The same verb without a direct object is intransitive, and it's not active. Active only refers to the voice. That is, the object receives the action of the verb. The third element is the mood, indicative. That's the only mood we've learned. Then the person, third person, and then the number, singular. The graph I, the I ending there, is third person singular, as we will learn. It is from grapho. That is the vocabulary form. That's the form that I will give you in the list every time we come to a verb. Third person singular from grapho. There's another example. This example has no stated subject. The subject's found in the ending of the verb. Ekamen, ton karpon. Amen ending is we. We have the fruit. And so when we diagram it, we is on the basal line as the subject in English, because there is no Greek word for that. We supply it. That way, if we put it in English, we know that it is actually there in the ending. That's our little shorthand for that. Now, I will tell you that in English diagramming, when this kind of thing happens, where you have especially an imperative where English leaves off the word you, we often put the word you in parentheses as the subject. But here, since we is an English word, we just leave it in the English form. Notice again, karpon is the accusative object, and ton is on the modifying line describing karpon. The parsing is present, transitive active, because it has a direct object. Indicative mood, first person, plural, from echo. It's plural now because we is a plural pronoun. It's the pronominal ending, we call it. Sometimes it's called a pronominal suffix for verbs because it contains the pronoun concept built into the verb. When no stated subject is provided, then, the student must look to the ending of the verb for the subject. The above example has no stated subject, so the subject pronoun has been provided in English. Diagramming the genitive case. Notice the following structure here. This is the genitive only. A genitive, as far as this course is concerned, is when we have the second form, singular or plural, translated with the word of. Now, if we translate it some other way, we will deal with that, and that will occur later in this in these lessons, but not right yet. Let's look at this first sentence. Blepomen, tous oikus, ton aklon. Blepomen is the word we see. It's blepo plus the amen ending, the we ending. Tous oikus, the houses. That's the accusative plural form, so it's the direct object of we see. Ton aklon, this is a genitive function of the second form, plural, of the crowds. So when we see that, we know that the word of the crowds describes houses by telling whose houses they are. And we diagram it, as I've shown you here, beneath the word oikos. When I do this, I simply extend the line down underneath oikos so that the modifying line includes aklon. Tous and aklon are parallel adjectives. You say aklon's a noun. Yes, it is. But it's a noun that's used as an adjective. So don't let that bother you. That's a common function. And I have a little paragraph on the next page. Oh, I have the parsing, present, transitive active, indicative, first person plural from blepo. Always give the vocabulary form. The genitive aklon shows to whom the noun oikos belongs. It is a possessive genitive and therefore acts as an adjective. Nouns used as adjectives are common in many languages, including English. For instance, in the sentence, the apartment manager is on vacation, the word apartment is a noun modifying manager, which makes it an adjective. And when, if you were to diagram that in English, you would have to diagram it beneath the word manager. The word apartment would go beneath the word manager as an adjective. Genitive nouns in Greek generally are adjectives. In fact, I will go so far as to say almost always adjectives, although some grammarians disagree a little bit on that. We'll talk about that later. Diagramming the ablative case. Now remember, the genitive and the ablative share the same form. The difference is in how we translate the noun. Here's an example that's a little more complicated, but I thought I would use this as an opportunity to teach some things that you might not be familiar with. The sentence is, Ugar estin diastole te iudaiou kai helenas. Pardon me. To helenas. Let me go through that again. Ugar estin diastole te iudaiou kai helenas. And this should be translated, there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. I'm going to tell you why we translate that in just a moment, why we translate it that way. At times, the ablative must be translated between, as it is here. The from translation only works sometimes. Now, this is important. But the word iudaiou can be translated of Jew or of the Jew. The word Hellenos can be the Greek or of the Greek. But in here, both of these are translated between Jew and Greek. That's because of the structure. So this adds something extra, and we will see this a lot in the Greek New Testament. Here I'm simply introducing it. You don't have to memorize it or try to learn it. It's just for your information, just to show you some interesting things about Greek. Let's go through this sentence again. The word ou, which starts the sentence, is the word no, or sometimes not. In fact, it is an adverb. The word gar is actually a conjunction, and it is a word that is called a postpositive. When we translated it, I left it out, because sometimes you can't translate gar. The word actually means for. And we have to diagram it as though it were the first word of the sentence. Because in English, for is the first word. Diastole means difference or distinction. The word te is actually the word and, but it's untranslatable. And kai is another word for and, which is translatable because it's Jew and Greek. But the te-kai combination really means both Jew and Greek, but when it is in a context like this, where diastole is used, it has to be translated between, because we use the word distinction or difference, things like that. We use the word between. We're talking about two elements. That's the rule that I want to talk about. When you translate, you must use the rules of English, not the rules of Greek. Yes, iudaiou and helenos can be translated of or from before both of them. But when you translate a whole sentence, you have to figure out what's going on and translate according to the rules of English. The rule is that the target language supplies the rules for the translation. Translation, then, is not the best way to understand what's going on. Now let's go and look at the diagram. The word gar, even though I didn't translate it, I could have said, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. I would have had to put it first. I didn't hear, just to show you that even if it's not there, it still carries meaning. You have to include it in your interpretation. Now, the word gar, we'll study later on, has basically two different functions. For the purposes of this lesson, it's enough to know that it becomes second or third in the sentence. That's called being post-positive. There are words that are forced to be first, pre-positive, but they're very rare. Post-positive, it's always second, sometimes third in the clause or sentence in which it occurs, but it's always diagrammed as I've diagrammed it there. That's what I call a conjunction line, an introductory conjunction line. We see that a lot in Greek. The subject is diastole. Now, in English, we have this foolish thing that we do with a dummy word, there, with a verb is. We say there is no distinction. Distinction, even in English, is still considered the subject of the verb. And when you were to diagram this in English, you would have to take the word there out and diagram, just like the Greek is, for distinction is. don't get confused here. The word order, even in English, sometimes varies between subjects and other things. You want to know where the word there comes from in English? It's a specialized use of a word function for the to put the verb first for emphasis sake, and it has become the standard by which we express these kinds of thoughts. We want, in English for some reason, to be for the verb to be before the subject in certain constructions. There is, there are, those kinds of things. This is an idiom of the English language. But to show the ablative case, we diagram it now, not beneath a noun, but beneath a verb, because the ablative is an adverbial idea. And there I've diagrammed that structure, that compound structure. And I've given you a little note that this is an example of a compound ablative structure. Eudaioi kai helenos, rough breathing by the way, helenos. The proper noun Helen comes from that Greek word, by the way. It means Greek. and the te is an introductory conjunction, but it's not translated. This brings me to one other comment about the nature of translation. Translation is not always straightforward. Sometimes you have to leave words out in the translation because they simply cannot work into the English requirement. They're required in Greek, but they're not required in English. This happens quite often. Like the word the. Sometimes the word the is required in Greek, but it's not in English. Sometimes the word is required, the is required in English, but it's not in Greek. English translation takes precedence over Greek original. That's the rule. It's too bad, isn't it? That's what people mean when they say something's lost in translation. That's required because of the nature of the translating function. Diagramming datives and locatives. Now, if you remember, the third form has datives, locatives, and instrumentals. I'm only going to talk about datives and locatives in this lesson. There's a reason for it. I'm going to show you, however, in an example, how to do an instrumental and how to translate one kind of instrumental. But we're not going to really zero in on that until later, and I'll show you why in a few moments. Datives, locatives, and instrumentals modify verbs. They're adverbial nouns, just like the ablative is an adverbial noun. Another common noun usage in English. Yes, we use nouns as adverbs all the time. In the sentence, the soldier went home yesterday. The noun home is an adverbial noun telling where the soldier went. The noun yesterday is an adverbial noun telling when the soldier went. Adverbial nouns. We use them all the time. For instance, another example. I gave mother a gift for her birthday. The word mother is an adverbial noun called an indirect object. You gave it to mother, to whom the act of giving was done, is adverbial. So we do it in English all the time. So does Greek. You just have to get used to it. Greek's a little bit more consistent, actually. We'll see. Here's an example. Hoi apostoloi, the apostles, pherousin, bring, or are bringing, or bear, or are bearing, depending on the context. There's no context for these words, so you can use any possible translation you want to, as long as it fits with the sentence. Artus, fruit, to the temple, to hiero. Now, that's the example of a dative noun, to hiero. And we diagram it as an adverb. Look at the diagram. Hoi apostoloi, the subject. The verb is pherousin. And the direct object is artus. And then the dative is hiero, or to hiero, diagrammed as you see, with the word to, an adjective referring back to hero. So hero is still a noun, but it's an adverbial noun and functions as an adverb. The parsing is there for you. Present, transitive, active, indicative, third person plural from Pharaoh. And I've just simply described this for you. The dative tohiro tells where the apostles bring loaves to the temple. So, or how the third form is translated depends on the meaning of the verb to which it is related. The following sentences uses the same form. However, the meaning is not dative but locative. Both indicate where, but in different ways. Here's the example. Hoi akloi blepusin tus lithus to hiero. There's that to hiero. But this one's going to be translated in the temple because of the verb. The crowds see or are seeing the stones in the temple. It tells where, but it tells where they are seeing in the temple. So in this case, it is considered a locative. See the difference? It's very important. How can you tell the difference between a dative and a locative? It's because of the verb. The meaning of the verb determines the dative or locative, or as we will see later on, even the instrumental usage. So the locative tells where the crowds are seeing the stones. And by the way, locatives generally show where, not always. Sometimes it's more of an abstract idea. Now I have a little paragraph on diagramming the instrumental case. Before discussing the instrumental case, it is best to study passive voice verbs. Because again, you will often see the dative case, the instrumental case with passive voice verbs. This will occur in a later chapter, so we must wait until then to discuss the instrumental use of Form 3 in detail. But see the second example below for one use of the instrumental. There's more than one. So the instrumental is a little more complicated, and we'll get to that in subsequent lessons. Diagramming compound structures. We've already looked at that a little bit, haven't we? The simple diagramming exercises included in this course will help the student understand the relationship between words. One regularly used relationship is called the compound structure. It often uses a conjunction to connect two elements of equal grammatical weight. When you have a conjunction of that type, it's called a compound conjunction or a coordinate conjunction, usually by grammarians. Note the following diagram. Lambano, dora, carpu, kai, artu. I receive, or I am receiving, or I am taking, or something like that. Lambano can mean both. Dora, gifts. Carpu, of fruit. Kai, artu, and bread. Or you could translate it, of fruit and of bread, but it's a little awkward. We just usually say of fruit and bread. But the genitive form would be the same. Here's the diagram. I is the subject. It's found in the ending. Dora is the object, gifts. And then you have the compound genitive structure of bread and fruit. There it is. This is the consistent way in which to do these. It will be very easy to spot a compound structure with this kind of a diagram. Plus, it becomes a good way to simplify your understanding and how to translate. I always diagram before I translate, because once you've diagrammed, the translation comes along much more easily. This is a typical genitive compound structure. It is found many times in the Greek New Testament. I cannot tell you the number. I mean, if you cannot hardly sit down to diagram a paragraph in Greek and not have several compound genitives. They're just very common. Below is an example of a compound predicate. You can actually have more than one verb, a predicate. Hoi angeloi, the messengers, gnoskousi thanaton, no death, kai, and didiskousin anthropous logos, and teach men, and here's an instrumental, logos, with words. One of the translations for the instrumental is not by, but with. If it's a neuter thing that is being used as an instrument, with words, because that's the English requirement. We don't say by words, we say with words in English. Hoi angeloi is the subject, and then there are two verbs, and so we have a compound predicate. Look at the diagram. Gnoskousin thanaton and didaskousin anthropous. Those are the compound predicates combined with chi, a coordinate or compound conjunction. It's better probably to call them coordinate because that's the English usage as well. Both each have their individual direct objects. And logois only goes with the second verb, with words. You don't know death with words. You know death with experience. But you know, you teach men with words. And so there's the correct diagram. You will notice that when you're diagramming, what you're really doing is interpreting. You cannot diagram without interpreting the use of the words. This is true in English. And one of the reasons it saddens me that we no longer teach diagramming in our English classes is because sometimes you have to interpret something that's even in your own language. And one good way to do it is by diagramming. It's not the only way, of course. If you're smart enough, and most of us aren't, I'm not, you can do it without diagramming. Or you can diagram in your head. I've gotten to the point where I can do that. But I will tell you that diagramming is a good way because it makes you look at the elements of the sentence. It is a good way to interpret or to begin the interpretation process. It's not the only thing there is to it, of course. So I have a chart here beginning with in paragraph 5.7, seven exercises, review exercises, and fill in that chart. I recommend that you take a copy of it or make a copy of it and fill it in over and over and over again. I will tell you that there is no greater way to learn than by filling in charts and saying them as you fill them in. Lesson 5, look if there's another chart. Where'd I get that? I put two of them down there. Do it at least twice. Do it over and over again. Fill in the blanks in the following chart. This is the endings. This is a good way to memorize the endings. Say them as you're filling them in. Memorize this chart. It will be good for you to exercise your brain power, and it will help a lot as we go through Greek. Translation and diagramming. I have listed sentences 1, 2, 3, 8, 13, and 14 for potential diagramming. Again, you're not required to do that. And eventually, I will have all of these sentences in a key diagram for you. These go down through 15 different sentences. I will read them for you. I'm not going to do this for every lesson, but I will read them for you for the first few lessons, just so you get used to hearing Greek being read. Number 1, hamesias, ekai, tein didakein, doxes, kai irenes. You see that kai? That indicates a compound structure. Number 2, ha apostolos, legai, tous lagus, parabolēs, tēs, te, glosē. Parabolēs is a genitive ablative form. Te glosē is a dative locative instrumental form. Number 3. Ha prophetēs, didaskai, parabolēn, tois, anthropois. That's a dative locative instrumental form in the plural. Te, tois, anthropois. Number 4. Ha angelos, blepai, ton prophetēn, te, ecclesia. Number 5, ha mathetes tu mesiu legai logus kai namus tois akloes. Number 6, hoi prophetai legusi parabolas tes basileias tois akloes. Number 7, hoi mathetai ton prophetone luusin ecclesias kai hiera lithois. Number 4, agais tus angelus, kai legais parabolein tes ecclesias. Number 9, legomen lagus, aletheias, aklois, anthropon, kai matheton. Number 10, acuete, tein parabolein, tes basileias, kai gnoskete, tein doxon, agapes. Number 11. Ha angelos, blepai, ton mesion, kai gnoskai, tein hemeron, irenes. Number 12. Ha prophetes, lambanai, Artan, Kai Karpon, to Huiu, to Prophet, Mathetu, I almost said Prophetu, Mathetu, the son of the prophet, of the disciple. Number three, Hoi Huioi, Gnoskusi, Tain Intelain, Kai Legusi, Tain Intelain, To Oiko. Number 14, Ha Apostolos, Graphai, Parabolain, Tes Basileias, Kai, Tes Ecclesias. Number 15, Hamathetes Gnoskai, Hamartion, Kai Legai, Logus Alethias. Alethias, rather. I accented that one. Alethias is not correct. Alethias is correct. That ends this lesson.